But the general outline of the story is known to most of us. Esther is written, as you know, about an event that occurs in the time of Xerxes, who is here called Ahasuerus. And this would put it late, not as late as Ezra and Nehemiah, for they come actually after this time, but rather late in the overall history of God's people in the Old Testament. Now, we have seen Daniel, and we have seen Ezra and Nehemiah, and in each of these, as well as in Ezekiel, we see that God is preserving His people. We see it from different points of view. In Daniel, we see how God preserved individuals and how He preserved Daniel and his companions. In Ezra and Nehemiah, we see how He preserved a whole people and brought them safely back and watched over them as they began to rebuild. In Ezekiel, we saw how God was preserving a remnant in spite of the fact that even there in captivity, there were many who were false and bringing false doctrines to the people. Here in Esther, we see how God preserved His whole people in a time when the entire Jewish people were threatened with extinction. The general outline and content of the book are shown in our outline that I have given you. The deposing of Queen Vashti and the choosing of Esther. The integrity of Mordecai, the plot against the Jews. Esther's act of bravery on behalf of her people. The plot against Mordecai and its failure, and then the deliverance of the Jews as a whole. The final exaltation of Mordecai. It's been said that, and it's true, that this book does not anywhere have the name of God. For this reason, there were in the early times when there were debates about which were and which were not the scripture, the word of God, even before Christ, there were debates about Esther and whether or not it should be counted. But very early it was counted, and for an obvious reason. God's name is not specifically mentioned in the book, but at the same time, the evidence of God's working here to preserve His people, the way in which the writer has shown the hand of God without specifically mentioning God is a very, very beautiful weaving here of this whole account. And so it rightfully belongs among the other books of the Old Testament. It clearly shows some of the things that the prophets have been declaring over and over, that God will protect His people, that He is concerned and will watch out for them. By this time, there were already a people of God who had gone back. Zerubbabel had already returned, and the temple was already rebuilt. Ezra and Nehemiah had not yet come down. And it may be that the events that are told here in the book of Esther had a tremendous purifying effect on the Jews and may have been a kind of base upon which Ezra and Nehemiah could then go on and do the work that God had called them to do. The first chapter tells of the deposing of Queen Vashti. Remember that Ahasuerus is better known in history as Xerxes, and he is the one who ultimately would meet defeat at the hands of the Greeks, not permanent defeat, but he would be seriously set back, and his conquest toward the west would end. They're not really mentioned in the book of Esther here itself, but the king as a personality is mentioned, and of course Esther and Mordecai, and they together with Haman are the four main characters in this account. Well, as the first chapter tells us, the king had a great feast, and he invited many of the nobles and rich to come to his feast. It reminds us of the descriptions of some of the big banquets we saw in Daniel, describing Nebuchadnezzar's banquets. Not Nebuchadnezzar so much as the last one to be held in Babylon at the time of the fall, Belshazzar. Anyway, in verse 8, the drinking was according to the law. None could compel, for so the king had appointed to all the officers of the house that they should do according to every man's pleasure. It was a kind of drinking party, apparently, and most of the people must have been drunk, but no one was compelled to drink. The king had a sense of propriety at that point, that no one would be compelled. So we're told on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry, that he ordered Vashti to be brought in so that all of the men there could admire her beauty. Now, we cannot help but admire Vashti and her refusal to come. The story is rather tragic as far as she's concerned, for in her own way, she was an heroic woman. She had her own integrity, her own self-respect, and she refused to do even what the king of this great and vast empire commanded her to do. She paid for her refusal in that she was deposed. For her, it was a tragic account. There's really not much more we can say about it. We don't know any more about her. But the reason why she was deposed is unfolded for us here in the last part of the chapter. The problem is expressed in verse 15. What shall we do unto the queen Vashti according to the law, because she has not done the bidding of the king? And this was something unheard of. And the answer came from advisors: the queen has not only done wrong to the king, but to the princes and all the people. For this deed of the queen will become known abroad among women and will make their husbands contemptible in their eyes. All of the wives would stop obeying their husbands. And this day will the princes of Persia and Media, who have heard of the deed of the queen, say unto all the king's princes in the same manner, and there will be much contempt and wrath. So it was ordered that Vashti should no more come before the king. And we are told in verse 21 that their advice pleased him. Now this then is the situation. Now it was out of this situation, which the Bible records here, that God begins to work a marvelous work among his own people and for the sake of his own people. The king desired to have a wife, and so it was desired that someone be sought who would take the place of Vashti. The suggestion is made in verse 2, let there be fair young virgins sought for the king. Now in verse 5 we're told there was a certain Jew there at the palace whose name was Mordecai, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives that had been carried away. You remember that there were Benjamites, people of the tribe of Benjamin, still identified with the people of the southern kingdom, that is, of Judah. And he had been carried away sometime about 597, we would expect. The statement here is misleading as we read it. One might assume that Mordecai himself had been carried away, but this would be too late, very likely. The captives that were carried away in 597, the time that is mentioned here in verse 6, of course, would have been a long, long time. That would have been much too long for Mordecai. He would have been well over 100 years old. What is probably to be understood here then is that he is the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite, and that the relative who goes with Kish and not with Mordecai. Though if one reads it here, he might assume that the relative pronoun who goes with Mordecai. Then as the account develops here, he undoubtedly heard of what was going on. He heard that they were seeking for a queen. And he brought Esther and commended her to be included. Now, Esther was a cousin, probably a very much younger cousin. The impression would be that Mordecai was certainly probably middle-aged. 30 or 40 maybe, we don't know. But Esther was a young woman. So it came to pass when the king's commandment and his decree were heard that Esther was taken to the king's house, to the custody of Haggai, the keeper of the women. And the maiden pleased him. As with Joseph, so with Esther. She won favor quickly. The evidence that God was working is to be seen then in the same way that God worked in the life of Joseph and blessed him when he was in a foreign court. Verse 10 tells us, incidentally, that Esther had not made known her background. They did not know that she was a Jew. The rest of the chapter tells us that she was pleasing, the king was pleased, and that he chose her. Chapter 2, toward the end, verse 19 to 23, tells of an incident. And here comes in one of the characteristics of this whole account. And that is the writer's tendency to tell incidents which might be called coincidence, but which, when one looks at the whole, cannot be called just coincidences, but certainly show behind them the hand of God working. One of these then is recorded here. Mordecai was sitting in the king's gate. Now this would mean that he was in the place of judgment there, because that's what the king's gate would be. It would be a rather high place, and probably showed that he had already earned a great deal of respect among the people and the king. Esther had not made her kindred known, so no one was connecting at this point Mordecai with Esther. But she was under his influence, and we're told in verse 20, Esther did the commandment of Mordecai. She obeyed him. While he was sitting there in the king's gate, he had occasion to overhear a plot against the king. He made this plot known, and the men were investigated. It was found out that they were actually plotting. They were summarily dealt with, and the whole record of the thing was written in the book of the Chronicles. Now, it was no chance that Mordecai overheard. It was no chance that the record was made. And more than that, it was no chance that Mordecai was not rewarded at this time. One sees behind all of this, as the account unfolds, that God's hand was there. All of these things, the fact that he overheard, the fact that his good deed was not rewarded, both of these things are unusual. At the same time, the plot thickens with the appearance of Haman, who felt very competitive and undoubtedly desired to be second in the kingdom. He wanted to be the right-hand man of the ruler. And he was held in high respect. He was advanced, and his seat was above everybody else, all the other princes, we're told in chapter 3, verse 1. So that all the king's servants in the gate would bow down. We see here then a group of men, probably those that were most close to the king, that were his counselors there at the king's gate. Among them was Mordecai. Mordecai was a Jew, and he was known to be a Jew. But in Persian Empire, Jews were respected in a general way. But as we've seen with Daniel and with others, Ezra and Nehemiah were all evidently respected Jews in the Persian Empire. But Mordecai greatly angered Haman because he would not bow down or show any reverence. He would show no respect for Haman. Now, he was warned that if he didn't change his way, he could get in trouble. But it made no difference. He was a man of great integrity and a man of great principle. So then, we find in verse 6 that he was afraid, that is, Haman was afraid to lay hands on Mordecai. And so, in order to get at Mordecai, he thought of a plot by which he could destroy all the Jews throughout the whole kingdom. And the plot against the Jews is unfolded for us here in chapter 3, beginning with verse 7. As the day was that they were casting the lot, which was apparently something to do with a custom in those days, that Haman took this occasion when he was in contact with the king directly to suggest that there was a dispersed people who had a law contrary to the Persian law. And his accusation is they do not keep the king's law. Therefore, it is not for the king's profit to suffer them. If it please the king, let it be written that they be destroyed. Now, the amazing thing is that apparently the king didn't inquire, well, who are you talking about? The king did not look into the matter to see if what he said about those people was true. He showed a blind and foolish confidence in Haman, and he therefore turned it all over to him and said, well, if you know of such a people, he probably thought he was talking about a handful of people. If you know such a people, then you go ahead and handle them any way you want to. One gets the impression that the king was rather remote from what was going on in his own kingdom. He didn't seem to know much about any of it. He seems to have shut himself up pretty much in these days, and perhaps he was preoccupied with his troubles in Greece to the extent that he didn't have time to worry about whatever it was Haman was talking about. He did not expect that Haman would use this occasion to take advantage of anything for himself, but he did not know his own advisor, Haman. So he took his ring, he gave it to Haman, and said, do what you will. So Haman had the word sent out that on a certain day, every Jew everywhere all over the world was to be killed. And this was spread everywhere. And the Jews heard of it, and it caused, obviously, great distress. Chapter 4 tells us that Mordecai was distressed. He rent his clothes. Esther didn't hear about it. Not being known to be a Jew, it was not something that would have come to her. She probably also lived in considerable exclusion, but she did hear that Mordecai was dressed in clothes of mourning, and she sent down some new clothes, said, put these on. Why are you sitting there like that? And he sent word back to her and told her why he was mourning. Verse 7, Mordecai told him, that is a messenger, of all that had happened to him and all that was to be done against the Jews, and ordered the messenger to charge her that she should go to the king to make supplication unto him and make request for her people. Now, this must have been a trusted servant. He obviously now knew that she was a Jew, but he didn't tell this. He just went back to her and told her what Mordecai had said. So the account goes she sent a message in verse 11. All the king's servants and everybody knows that if anybody comes to the king without being invited, he's to be put to death unless the king holds out his scepter. And I haven't been to the king in a month. Now, one gets the impression then that Esther was reluctant at this point to stick out her neck. Maybe she was not impressed with how serious this thing was. But Mordecai, her cousin who had brought her up, sent back some strong words in verse 13. Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then will relief and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house will perish. And who knoweth whether thou art not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? She really lays the burden of it now on her. Esther, don't think that you can hide in the palace and escape. Don't think that your identity won't be known. And even if you refuse to help now, be sure deliverance will come. Now again, he doesn't mention God, but he makes this positive statement on the obvious basis of his knowledge of God and how he's dealt with his people in the past. He is convinced of God's hand in this, that God has put her in this place not for her glory, but in order that at this point she can be the Redeemer. She can be the means of God's people being saved from destruction. He has here then a real clear sense of providence. After all, he's seen God raise up kings and put down kings. And he realizes now that she was made queen just for this purpose. Again, it's no coincidence that Esther, out of all of the beautiful women of a whole empire, that one girl was chosen. Now, this impressed itself upon Esther, obviously, for she responds in verse 16, I will go into the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish. I believe that Esther showed here a real change of heart. She was now convinced that Mordecai was right, that she had an obligation, that God had put her there for a purpose, and that she must now be consistent in her own faith in God and go forward. If she perished, she perished. She laid her life on the line. Her own heroism and bravery then cannot be denied her at this point. She does go in, and she, in a very interesting way, lays the trap for Haman. She was wise enough to know that she couldn't go in and begin to point the finger at Haman and say, well, now, he's done this and this and this, and it's against my people. She lays the trap. She delays also. And her very delay itself may, and seems to me, well, could have been another part of God's purpose without her being conscious of that. She invited the king and Haman to have dinner with her. And they come, and the king says, well, now, you didn't just do this for nothing. You've got something you want. She said, well, yes. Come again tomorrow night, you and Haman, and I'll let you know what it is then. Now, in that interval, in that night, some interesting things happen. First of all, Haman goes home. He's so glad. He has been shown favor now, not only by the king, but by the queen. He's been put in the choice place. Only he and the king and the queen ate dinner together. And yet, as he went out that night, full of joy, he saw Mordecai, and it made him mad again. And he went in and pouted to his wife. And she and his friends counseled him, we're told in verse 10. Much in the same way, I suppose, that Jezebel tried to comfort Ahab. Oh, don't worry, just take care of him. We'll take care of him. And the suggestion was, build a gallows and hang him on it. That's the way you get rid of him. So that's what he did. And after that, he was happy to go on the next day to the dinner. Chapter 6 tells us of another event that occurred that same night. That is, the king had a sleepless night. This, too, was no coincidence. That night he was sleepless, and he needed a sedative. And what better sedative could there be than to read the chronicles of the history there, the relation of so-and-so begat so-and-so. That would put him to sleep for sure. And as it was being read, it just happened that the account of Mordecai and what he had done was read to him. Now again, this didn't just happen. It wasn't just chance that of all the volumes that could have been read, this was the one that was read. And as it was heard, he quickly asked, well, what's been done for Mordecai? And they said, nothing. The record shows nothing. So the story unfolds in an amusing way. The next morning, he calls in Haman and he says, Haman, what should the king do for the man he delights to honor? And in his vain pride, Haman couldn't think of anybody the king would want to honor more than himself. So he described just the way he would like it, to be led through the city and everybody honoring and glorifying him as he was led through the city. And so we can imagine how he felt when he was told to do this to Mordecai. It's one of the most masterful stories that has ever been written, and even unbelievers have praised it as one of the best short stories. Of course, they call it just fiction, of course, but that's what they call it, one of the best short stories ever written. Now then, chapter 7 again tells of the second dinner of Esther, how they come in and eat, and this time she begins by saying in verse 3 in chapter 7, if I found favor and if it please the king, let my life be given me and my people at my request. That's a beautiful petition. I mean, who would object to that? The king couldn't have any problem there. Surely I'll spare your life. What are you talking about, Esther? There's nobody threatening you. You see, it built up in him a kind of indignation. What on earth are you talking about? Why, certainly nobody. For we are sold, and I and my people to be destroyed. Now you can imagine the indignation at this point. Just tell me who. Who is he? Where is he that durst presume in his heart to do so? I wish we could know what was in the mind of Haman at that point. You can just see the sweat loosening his collar, wishing he was anywhere but right there. And she points the finger, and now he gets down on his knees and he pleads with the king. So mad he stalks out of the room. He won't say anything. He gets down on his knees and pleads with her, and just while he's down there holding on to her, the king comes back in and accuses him of taking the advantage of his absence to touch his wife. And so nothing went right with Haman that day. It was a bad day altogether. And they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had planned to hang Mordecai on. Now the rest of the account simply is a climax to the whole here. And it tells in chapter 8 and 9 how the counter-proclamation went out that the Jews could defend themselves. And as it went out, actually it was obvious then that the king favored the Jews, and really those that tried to lay a hand on the Jew or his property would suffer punishment. And now the situation was reversed, and the non-Jews, at least the enemies of the Jews, began to be afraid and began to convert. Even in verse 17, many people from among the people of the land became Jews, for the fear of the Jews was falling on them. Then we're told of the establishment of a memorial day, the Purim, which comes from the word pur, which is the word for cast, which is the day, you remember, when Haman began to cast his plan to destroy the Jews. God turned that black day into a day of gladness for the Jewish people. Chapter 10 tells us how Mordecai was thereafter exalted, and of course he took the place that formerly had been that of Haman. And read in verse 3, Mordecai the Jew was next to King Ahasuerus and great among the Jews and accepted of the multitude. He was in a later day what Daniel was apparently in the early history of the Persian Empire. The whole account then, as we have said, though it does not mention God, very obviously shows the hand of God and how God can overturn the evil plots of evil men to work out his purpose and to save his people. It comes rightly into the Word of God as a constant testimony that God knows at every moment the needs of his people, that God knows their needs even before they do, but because even before Haman's plot was unhatched, God had already put Esther in the key place. Now, Haman probably would have never tried this if he had known Esther was a Jew and that she was kin to Mordecai. He didn't know any of this. And so the likelihood is that in his evil heart, God also desired very much to judge him. And the whole account, then, is a testimony that God is in control of history. And it's a worthy account for us to remember. Now let's turn to Haggai. Haggai is a brief prophecy. The outline that I have given you here shows us that the chief problem, the chief burden of Haggai is the problem that God's house is not yet finished. You remember that when they were forced to stop building, they just went about other business, and Zerubbabel and the others apparently lost sight of why they had come back for a time, and it was Haggai and Zechariah specifically who were raised up. You read of this in Ezra 5 and 6, that Haggai and Zechariah were raised up to preach to the people and get them going again in building the house of the Lord. Now Haggai brings out clearly that the solution to the problem, that is, that they are not finishing God's house, is that the people stop putting themselves first and start putting God first. The people do respond and build a house, and thereby God is glorified. This is the bulk of the book, and let's look at it then in content now. The problem, as we've already said, is that God's house has not been finished. So in the second year of Darius, the word of the Lord came by Haggai the prophet to Zerubbabel and Joshua. He said to them, "Is it not the time for us to come and the time for the Lord's house to be built? Is it a time for you yourselves to dwell in your sealed houses while this house lies waste?" Again, we see then that there was something lacking here. The people were more concerned for their own well-being than they were for God's house, and it was to build God's house that they had come back in the first place. Verse 5 and also verse 7 and chapter 2, verse 15. Use one of the favorite words, also 2:18. Use a favorite word of Haggai, or say a favorite method or approach. He says, "Consider your ways. Consider. Look at yourselves. See what you're doing, what you're not doing. Now look at the situation. You've sown much and you don't bring in much. You've eaten, but you're not full. You drink and you're not full. You're clothed, but you're not warm. You earn wages, but it's like carrying it around in a bag with a hole in it. The wages escape from you." In other words, why has all this happened? Why is this the way it is? There's no blessing from God. Well, the point is, as he begins to show this solution in the second section here, consider your ways. Weigh yourself and your situation. Why are you not blessed? Go to the mountain, bring wood, build a house, and I will take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified. verse 9, my house that lies waste while you run every man to his own house. Now God says in verse 10, I, for your sake then, have withheld these blessings. Because your purpose in coming here was to build this house, since you have not put my house first, I have withheld the blessing so that you might be brought back to your senses. God would not have the people to go through the same thing that they went through before the exile, neglecting God and putting themselves first. And so he has withheld blessings to call them back to their senses. Now you remember that when God did this the first time, when God did this with Israel of old, when he withheld blessings, it didn't make any difference. When he warned them by the prophets, it didn't make any difference. But we see here a different type of Jew. These people hear and they take to heart what the prophet says. One of the striking things then about the post-exilic people of God is that when they hear the prophet, or when they hear Ezra or Nehemiah rebuke them for sin, like David, they confess their sin. They recognize it and they correct themselves. And so we see that one of the great things God said by the prophets before the fall has really come to pass. God has, in a way, put an obedient heart in the people. There is a more ready response to obey God, and for this reason the people are preserved over those hundreds of years that are yet to come before the Christ. So we read here in verse 12 following that the people respond. They obey the voice of the Lord. The people fear the Lord. And God says, I am with you, as he had said with Moses and Joshua and others long before. The Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, and they came and did the work on the house. Chapter 2 then describes the completion of that work. Verse 3, who is left among you that saw this house in its former glory? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes as nothing? You remember in Ezra 3:12 that the people had mixed emotions when they saw the beginning of the house of the Lord again. And those that had seen it before wept. And we said at that time that perhaps part of their weeping was because it looked so much like a little thing, so little compared to that glory that Solomon had adorned the first with. But God doesn't say that. He assures them, look, I am with you. That makes the difference. Verse 4, he says, I am with you. And that's what makes this house glorious. And then in verse 7, I will fill this house with glory. The silver is mine. The gold is mine. The latter glory of this house shall be greater than the former. God says, I will glorify this house. I will be here, and my presence here with you is what will give it its true glory. Don't worry about all the gold and silver and glitter of the other one that lacks here. That's not really important. What matters is whether God is here. Now the people have obeyed, they have rebuilt the temple, God is glorified, and all is well. Haggai goes on to challenge the people in much the same way he had before. He says, keep on considering. Consider your ways. If you worship me with unclean hands, if you offer me what is unclean, then you will not be acceptable. Verse 15, now I pray you, consider from this day and backward, before a stone was laid on stone in the temple of the Lord, through all that time, when one came with a 20 measures, he only had 10, and so forth. I smote you with blasting, yet you turned not to me. Consider from this day and backward, since the day of the foundation of the Lord's temple was laid, consider it. Now what Haggai seems to be doing here is trying to bring in, to really bear in on the people, the lesson that has been taught. When you put God first and God is glorified, then you're blessed. But when you neglect God and you go after what interests you, then you consider what happened. Your lives were not blessed. So I understand the latter part here from verses 10 to 19 of Haggai chapter 2 to be primarily a statement again of the lesson that he had brought out in chapter 1. That is, that unless you put the glory of God and his work first in your life, then your life will not be blessed. He closes with a brief promise to Zerubbabel. Speaks of the God's judgment, the typical judgment of God against the nations. He finally says, in that day, I will take thee, O Zerubbabel, my servant, and I will make thee as a signet, for I have chosen thee, says the Lord of hosts. Now Zerubbabel here seems to be a type of God's chosen one to deliver the people. And I understand then the remarks here regarding Zerubbabel in the sense that he was given the office of getting God's house built. That he's a type of the one whom God will choose to truly build God's temple among his people. Namely, a type of Christ in that he here is appointed to the rebuilding of the temple. You remember that Christ himself compared his own body to the temple when they were talking about the temple that was in Jerusalem, and Jesus said in talking with some of the Pharisees, well, you destroy this temple and I'll rebuild it in 3 days. I'll raise it up again in 3 days. And they said, well, this temple's been built for years and years and it still isn't finished, and you say you're going to rebuild it in 3 days? And the scripture goes on to say that Jesus was talking about his own body. The real temple, the real dwelling of God among his people in the flesh. But, as we say, Zerubbabel simply is a type here, and in this sense is used here at the end of the book of Haggai. Now then, before we go on, we still have Zechariah and Malachi to look at, but before we go on, let's take a brief time for any questions on Esther and Haggai that you have. We'll start over here.
In Haggai, this last 19, the New American Standard translates the word for look backward, but look forward, which completely changes the thought that you just went through. It's the word translatable either way. You say that it's another one of the places you don't like the translation.
What does, I'm not familiar with what it says. Now, what verse 9 in particular are you talking about here?
Well, 18, it says, do consider from this day onward, to give the marginal note, it says, or backward.
Mm-hmm.
And with the thought process, you just gave it.
Yeah. Do they give any reason there for saying forward? Except
they give you both, but this forward or onward is the one in the text, the marking
of those. Yeah. Well, I'll check it out between the sessions here and see exactly what the Hebrew word is. I don't have my Hebrew text with me. But this passage usually, this translation usually will indicate if they have varied from the ordinary meaning. My guess is that it would be the Hebrew word acharit, or the word that means back, behind. But I'll check it out just to be sure, and let me do that. Nehemiah, Ezra, and Zerubbabel? No. Zerubbabel was about 50 or 60 years ahead. Zerubbabel was in the first return, right after the decree of Cyrus, 538 roughly. You see, this was much earlier than Ezra and Nehemiah. They came in the time of Artaxerxes, which is at least 50 years later. They were not contemporary.
Nehemiah
and Ezra were contemporaries. Ezra came first, and then Nehemiah after him several years, but they were together. Haggai and Zechariah, though, prophesied not in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, before that, in the time of Zerubbabel.
I have two questions. In the book of Esther, by not mentioning, of course, God's name specifically, putting it out in part A, there must be many attacks on the book of Esther. Could you briefly tell us what the major ones are and very briefly how they're dealt with?
Attacks by the critics on Esther? No, this doesn't bother the critic at all. The critic would probably call it fiction. Probably with no real basis. It was just a story written to encourage the Jews. But the fact that it doesn't have the name of God in it would not bother the critic at all. What...
Would you even pick this up and use it?
He
wouldn't pick this up. In fact, it doesn't.
Well, he would note it, but I say that would not bother him. The critic's problem here would be with the question of whether it was history or not. And most critics would reject it. They might say there's a figment of truth. Maybe something local did happen, but certainly not anything that affected the whole kingdom. The critic would not be bothered by the fact that God's name was not there because, well, with the critics as a whole, after all, their overall view is that it's basically a human literature anyway. And so whether or not God's name was there would not matter to them. The ones that are bothered by it are people who usually have a high respect for the Word of God and are concerned that God's name is not specifically mentioned.
In the book of Haggai, the task was specifically to build the temple. Now, you pointed out that this was in showing people that unless God's work is done first, they won't be blessed. The book chapter. Well, what about the task of specifically building the temple? How does that apply today?
The question of how the principle here of putting God's work first or the building of the temple.
The specific building of the temple, structure.
Well, I think that here God had sent his people back. He had sent them back with a special commission to rebuild the temple. And it was this that was to be first. We've already seen the strong emphasis in the post-exilic period on not only the temple, but the priesthood, and primarily the restoration of the law. And this is what all of it was working toward. See, it was not just the temple. Because once the temple had sat there, Solomon's temple had sat there and had not helped the people at all. It was the temple. It was the worship in the temple. It was the restoration of the law of Moses and the people putting that law in effect in their lives, in every aspect, in worship, and in obedience and in every respect, as we saw in Ezra and Nehemiah, putting everything under the law of God. And this was just a portion of that. Just building the temple itself was not the end, of course. You say, how would we apply this? I don't know specifically whether we need to worry about an application of the building of the temple so much, but the work of God and the glory of God is certainly the great lesson here. God wanted this temple finished, his people brought back to him, subjected to him so they could worship him properly and glorify him as the people of God. That's what he intended by bringing them back. Now, in our day, of course, God has His will for us. His work for us is expressly declared, not only to bear much fruit to His glory in our lives, but to preach His word and proclaim His truth to the ends of the earth. All of this is part of our work today in God's kingdom. And that, too, must come first. And it should be first above everything else. Now, that's the way I would want to apply it.
You didn't mention anything about the author of the Book of Acts. Did you come to
the conclusion? I don't know who wrote it. I have no idea. I mean, I find no evidence, and I don't think really anyone knows. Nothing could be more than just a wild guess, I would think. No, as to the authorship of Esther, I would not know. Any other questions? Well, we have a little time here. Let's at least start looking at Zechariah, and then we'll continue at the end of our rest period. Zechariah, first, let's look at the outline I've given you. Zechariah basically is a series of visions, 8 in number, followed by specific messages that are given to Zechariah. Now, messages come through the visions, of course, but messages also come in specific ways through certain revelations that are given to Zechariah. And I didn't complete here. It should be C should read 6:9 to 14:21. That is the end of the book. So you can see that this book, again, is roughly divided into two parts. The first part is concerned mainly with visions of Zechariah. This book, contemporaneous with Haggai, therefore, in the time of Zerubbabel, and we're told that Zechariah, along with Haggai, was instrumental in getting the people started back in the building of the temple. Zechariah starts out with a history lesson. Verse 2, "The Lord was sore displeased with your fathers, therefore say thou unto them, Thus saith the Lord, Return to me, and I will return to you. Be not as your fathers, whom the former prophets cried to, and they wouldn't listen. Your fathers, where are they? The prophets, do they live forever? But my words and my statutes, which I command my servants the prophets, did they not overtake your fathers?" So you see, Zechariah's burden, similar to that of Haggai, is, now, you listen. You listen to what's been said. You pay attention. Don't put yourselves ahead of God, but God's will first. Don't do like your fathers, who, when they were warned by the prophets, didn't listen. Now, God's raised up Haggai, and He's raised up me to preach to you and to call you to do His work. Now, get busy. Don't follow the pattern of the older, your forefathers, the older Israel. Then comes a series of visions. And the first of these visions is given to us here, a man on a red horse. I saw a man riding on a red horse. And there were other horses, red, sorrel, white. Well, let's pause and we'll come back to the visions after our break.